Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
When Julian Assange published thousands of US diplomatic cables last year through WikiLeaks, he opened up a debate that's actually been brewing for years about what information the public has the right to know, what should remain a secret. To some people, including our own Prime Minister Julia Gillard, Assange was an enemy of the establishment, a danger to diplomacy. To others, an international hero for his work lifting the lid on oppressive regimes around the world. One writer who's kept a close eye on the controversy is Mika Sifri. He's written a book called WikiLeaks and the Age of Transparency, and he joins us tonight on Open House. Mika, welcome.
Oh, good to be here.
Thanks very much for joining us. I want you to take us back to just 6 months ago, November 2010. Exactly what were the documents, recall for us, that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks released?
So what they released, this was actually the third of a series of major leaks of secret U.S. documents, the first two having been the war logs from Afghanistan and then from Iraq. And then this giant trove of State Department internal diplomatic cables, mainly correspondence from the embassies around the world that were being shared internally over the last few years, post 9/11 irony. The government had decided to increase information sharing internally, and while we don't know exactly how these cables fell into WikiLeaks' hands, the strong belief is that it was Bradley Manning, a private first class stationed in Iraq, who came upon them and decided for reasons of conscience, we think, to give them to WikiLeaks. So far, only a few thousand of these cables have actually been published. It's hard to keep track of the exact number because they are being distributed through a wide array of news organizations, and WikiLeaks itself, I think, doesn't even have full control of the entire cable archive. But it's safe to say that the vast majority have not even been released yet and may never see the light of day.
Yes, so there may well be much more to come. And the world has never seen anything like this. He's been called, Julian Assange, a hero. Others call him a criminal. What's your view, having written this book and having thought through and seen all this? Hero, criminal, either, both?
Well, there's no way that he's a criminal. I mean, I believe very strongly in the freedom of the press to publish truthful information, and it's absolutely vital that we ensure that when truthful information, be it official government documents or secret corporate documents, come into the hands of the media, that they have great freedom to publish that, and that it should not be criminalized. The leaker may have broken a government law or contract as a government employee to not leak classified information, but once that information makes its hands into the press, the presumption should be to allow publication, and then add the expectation that the publisher should behave responsibly and not just dump information willy-nilly without any attention to perhaps the unintended consequences. And so here, WikiLeaks had started out with a model where they would just put whatever was sent to them out online. This is what in their first few years. But around these major leaks, they've adopted an approach where they're partnering with major media, newspapers, and so on, and redacting a great deal of the sensitive information that might expose someone who's a human rights activist or some other kind of confidential informant to danger. And so far, for all the hue and cry about Assange being a high-tech terrorist, there's no evidence that anyone has been harmed because of these releases. Some diplomats and other political figures may have lost their jobs, because of embarrassment, but that's hardly the kind of harm that we should be worrying about.
I wonder whether one of the responses and the results of WikiLeaks has been within the system, within governments, corporations, institutions, that they are now much more secretive with their information. They keep it more and more under wraps, fearing exposure.
Well, I think, at least in the American context, and this may well be true for Australia, I don't know, that you have to understand that the starting context here is that we have been living through an epidemic of overclassification. There are many, many mundane things that are part of just the normal operation of government that are withheld from public view, stamped secret or you know, not for publication. And this has nothing to do with protecting national security, and mostly just a reflex that the bureaucracy has taken on. And to some degree, it's about internal bureaucratic control. You know, information is power, right? So as governments have grown so big, part of what happens here with classification is just a game of, you know, I know something you don't know. And the problem is that the public suffers when we don't really know what's being done in our name with our tax dollars. And when, by and large, most of the time, the information that's being hidden from us is not to protect, you know, some undercover spy somewhere or some secret intelligence gathering program that's highly sensitive, but it's just to protect people from embarrassment. Top government officials in the United States leak secret information all the time, and they do it by handing leaks over to, you know, favored reporters, and they do it to fight bureaucratic battles, and they're never punished. It's these unauthorized leaks that get everybody upset. But the larger public interest here is that we need a more, the default setting should be towards transparency, not towards secrecy, especially for powerful actors. When you know that your behavior may be exposed to public view, you tend to behave better if you're a person in power. If you think you can hide your behavior from public view, the temptation to abuse power is much greater.
Do you think governments do need to keep some secrets, some classified information in the world of diplomacy, especially in the realm of defense, national security?
Yeah, I think that there's no question of that. And indeed, one of the effects of these leaks will be that the government will improve its security procedures on the stuff, hopefully, that truly needs to be kept secret. And you might ask, how was it that allegedly a private first class could have even accessed this information?
Very good question. Yes.
Yeah, and the answer is that they, you know, when you create a system where 2 or 3 million people actually have security clearances, which is the estimate here in the United States, no one knows for sure. They can't even get an accurate count. When you have such a system where so many people have access to classified information, you have to ask if it's even really secret anymore.
Yes.
I mean, let's not be naive. You know, the government of China or Russia surely can find one person out of 3 million who's a weak link who might sell them access to this information. And you know, the weak link in a massive system of secrecy is the only thing you have to worry about. So I think absolutely governments have good reasons to keep certain things secret. But for example, was it important to keep secret the fact that the U.S. military was indeed tracking on a daily basis the number of Iraqis killed and wounded, whether they were civilian or military, during our invasion and occupation of Iraq? For years, our government told us we don't do body counts, quote. In fact, they were doing a body count, and it turns out, based on the logs that WikiLeaks obtained, that the number of civilian deaths, as well as the number of Iraqis killed in sectarian violence, was much higher than we were being told. Who, you know, certainly it was not a secret to the people whose relatives were being killed or tortured. The only people who were being kept in the dark were, you know, me and my fellow citizens who were paying for this whole thing.
Yes. On Open House tonight, we're with Mika Sifri, the author of WikiLeaks and the Age of Transparency. Mika, I think central to the Age of Transparency about which you write is the internet, I think in the days when print, radio, TV ruled alone, we were all just kind of spectators, had to accept whatever was dished out to us. That has so much changed with the internet, hasn't it?
Yeah, that is really the reason why I didn't write this book and give it the title The Age of WikiLeaks. I think WikiLeaks is part of a much larger trend, which is that today we all carry in our pockets devices that have computing and connecting power magnitudes greater than what the astronauts took when they flew to the moon back in the late 1960s. And as a result, we are capable of participating actively as creators and sharers of information in all aspects of our lives. And so we were seeing an explosion of participation in every way. And this phenomenon cannot be only in the realm of social life and commerce, and it has to hit politics and government too. And in fact, it is doing that. And the old way of doing things, which sometimes it was just for practical reasons that government withheld information. It was very costly to print copies of the budget and make them available. But today, it doesn't cost anything to make a copy online, and so our assumption, which is that we ought to know, we have a right to know in all these other arenas, and that we have the ability to access information in real time, and not just access it, but comment on it, improve it, critique it, share it, point to the most important parts of it, that we're going to apply those same kinds of behavior and judgment to the work of government, which is, after all, some of the most important stuff in our lives. So that's what I mean by the age of transparency.
Yes. Mind you, at the same time, it does put enormous pressure on governments to look more and more at the process of how they do things rather than what they do, just the business of government. We have governments around the world, we know this in Australia, run by the 24-hour news cycle, or the news cyclone, as it's been called. I wonder whether it's always all good for government?
Well, I think it's a challenge to a certain kind of top-down government that we grew up with because, the industrial bureaucratic approach is what government has done for decades, and then the era of television where, one person can speak to millions, and therefore, power flows from the people who control the TV stations. So this is a challenge to government because information moves faster than government. People connecting to each other can tell each other things much faster than government can. But the flip side is, I think, many, many opportunities for what I like to call we government, as opposed to e-government. We being we, the people along with government, being able to take information, whether it's official government data, or the data that we can generate directly because we take a picture of a pothole and post it online, or indirectly because our movements are trackable, and create new kinds of services that actually break down some of this top-down bureaucratic industrial role of government in the first place.
Yes.
You can do a lot more with less today if you realize that there's this big civic surplus of people with free time on their hands. Instead of watching TV, I can, make an edit to Wikipedia and contribute to the world's greatest free encyclopedia of knowledge, right? Why not think of a lot of government tasks in the same way, and instead of imagining that you have to hire more government workers and raise taxes to pay for them, that instead you open up government as a platform for engagement to enable citizens and the professionals. Yes, we do need lots of people who have expertise, but a great deal of what we've come to call government is just this edifice that we built up during the industrial age.
Yes.
Now we are in an information and connection age, and so I think the opportunity, and we're seeing this bubble up all over, is for people to co-create with government new ways of sharing information, identifying problems and identifying solutions, and then working on them together.
Mika, are there organizations beyond the WikiLeaks thing brave enough almost to be joining in this age of transparency and actually engaging with the public and allowing that kind of participation about which you speak and write?
Well, there are lots of examples that I give in my book of these. I mean, I'm focused particularly on the ways that people are working with official government information as well as citizen-generated information to shine more light on the dark corners of government and legislatures, where often there's a great deal of waste and corruption because people just can get away with it, right? They don't think everybody is watching them. And so here in the U.S., we have the Sunlight Foundation. There's the open government movement all around the world. There are projects that are coming, that are bubbling up as people realize that this is not rocket science and that the tools are, in many cases, open source and free. And, you know, we can watch from below, if you will, on the people who are supposedly watching us from above. The other kinds of things that are beginning to develop are platforms sometimes generated by cities, where the city government is taking a progressive approach, or where developers, by whom I mean software developers, people who write apps for mobile phones and so on, are just taking matters into their own hands. I mean, there's a product here in New York City where I live called Exit Strategy, where a developer simply got the maps of all the city subways and created a mobile app that enables you to see at any station stop if you want to figure out where you should stand in the train to be as close as possible to the exit. You know, you just go through this app. Now, you could argue that that's something that the city transit authority should have created and made available to the public the same way they make free maps available, but they didn't, because they don't move fast enough. They're not thinking yet in that mode. But simply by making the data available, these third-party developers were able to create these new kinds of services, and some of them are free and some of them are businesses.
Yes.
So that's where the movement is going, and we are seeing really in at an amazing pace, people in cities around the world are linking up and saying, let's make sure our cities all share data in common ways so that if I'm going to build an app for my city, it could also work in your city. The same way if I were building a train 150 years ago, I would want the gauge on the train tracks be a certain standard width so that my train can travel from my city to yours. So we're in a similar place now with open data standards for these kinds of common government projects or civic projects or what I call we government projects.
Mika, in addition to those kind of benefits and the whole participatory age in which we live, in this age of transparency, I think the WikiLeaks thing also comes down to, in many ways, a debate about truth and whether we can, in the words of that great quote from the film, handle the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth.
You know, I think the challenge, there are two challenges that we face going forward, which is, what information can we trust? And we're going to have a struggle over this for a while. Part of the reason we have a struggle is, for too long, people in power have lied with impunity, and they've created a lot of cynicism. It's become difficult to know whether you can trust the authorities, the so-called authorities, if they're not being open and transparent. That's problem number one. Problem number two is that right now we're living through this explosion of expression where everybody is speaking. It used to be that, you know, freedom of the press belonged to him who could own one. Well, now we all own one in our pockets.
Yes.
And so you're seeing a cacophony of voices, including people who are trying to spread their own version of the truth, including claiming things like President Obama is a Muslim, or you know, that global warming is a myth. And, you know, this is a battle that it will take some time to sort out. It's worth remembering, you know, when the printing press was invented 500 years ago, it wasn't as if the Enlightenment just happened a year later. It took a while for people to grow new social norms, to figure out, what do we do with all... Now we have access to printed material in ways that we never had before, but it took 100 years until the convention, for example, that some written material is fiction and some written material is nonfiction, to really get codified, okay? I mean, today, you and I know, if we pick up a novel, it's not the truth. But we don't have that same convention for reading something that's on the Internet. And so we need a new kind of digital literacy to go along with the regular form of literacy so that you can make informed judgments. Just because you see a photograph, say, of Bin Laden, you know, after he was killed, those photographs were circulating online, and even some U.S. senators were gulled into believing that they saw the genuine photograph when, in fact, nothing had been released.
Yes.
So that's called digital literacy. You need to know that Photoshop can be used to fool you. And we are going to go through, I think, some years of sorting this out, and entrepreneurs are going to build us tools to meet the needs of a digital society. I need my website to immediately start flashing if it thinks the photo it's showing me is a fake.
Yeah. It's an amazing right? age in which we live, and it's been a fascinating conversation, and one of many to come, I'm sure. Mika Sipri, thanks very much indeed for joining us on Open House tonight.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Thank
Anytime.
You. Mika Sipri, author of the new book WikiLeaks and the Age of Transparency.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.